Welcome to the Music Career Show, telling you the stories of the world's best professional musicians.
Hello there and welcome to the Music Career Show. My name is Barry and every week I'll be speaking with incredible musicians from all over the world about how they've honed their craft and made a career out of doing what they love the most. If you're a new listener, then while you still have your device in your hand, please take a second to subscribe and tell your friends all about the Music Career Show.
Hello there and welcome back to the Music Career Show.
I'm Barry Carroll and each week I delve into the world of building a thriving music career by interviewing remarkable musicians and professionals from a diverse range of sectors. My goal is to inspire you with real life stories and glean wisdom from industry insiders, empowering you to make music your livelihood. Please subscribe, review and share the Music Career Show to all your friends. And as I say, help me spread the love. Now, so today I have a guy that over the past decade, he has been skillfully blending his passion for drumming and acting, which is an odd combination. And I'm really looking forward to getting into this one. So as an actor come musician, he has participated in numerous theatre shows. He's dazzled audiences as a guest entertainer on cruise ships and much more besides. So this is Josh Haberfield. How are you, Josh?
Hello, I'm great. Thanks, Barry.
Great. So Josh, for people that might not have heard of you just yet, why don't you introduce yourself to the nice people?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm Josh. I work mostly as an actor musician. So in the world where it's either film, TV or theatre, where we are telling stories about people that either are real life musicians who require actors to play instruments as well, or especially more in the theatre world, maybe stories that are used music to help tell a through line, or maybe just aids telling a through line. So there's this whole world of actor musicianship that, to be honest with you, until I graduated, I wasn't really aware of. But I'd say 85% of my work tends to be because I also play the drums as well as act. It's been a really nice nook to just fall into, really.
Very good. So like you said, like you're on TV and stuff. That didn't even occur to me to like even think of some talking points for that. So let's just before I go, let's just like segue into that a little bit. What have you been on telly? What have you been in on telly?
What have I been on telly? Most recently, the most rock and roll job ever. I've done some kids TV.
Yes.
Which, for Channel 5, I'm in a show called Mimi's World. It's a lovely little show. It's like a modern day retelling of Mary Poppins. Which is nice. But then other than that, Good Omens was one.
Part of that.
The Halcyon.
I've not heard that. No,
it's an ITV thing that was pit to be as good as Downton Abbey.
I've never seen Downton Abbey. That whole British aristocracy thing doesn't tend to fly well with
That's
Irish.
Funny that, isn't it? I have no idea why. But have you just had a lovely weekend?
So for anyone not in the know, today is Tuesday, the 9th of May. Being the day after King Charles's coronation. I keep forgetting what it's called, coronation. I don't know how I've managed to forget what it's called because I've not heard the end of it for the past fucking God knows how many weeks and months at this stage. But I just keep myself to myself. What was it that your one said? I'm Switzerland.
Nice. Yeah, that's the best way to be.
That's the best way to be.
Neutral.
Yeah. Completely neutral. Yeah, can't get into trouble either way.
Absolutely.
Well, anyway, we're completely digressing. We started off having a lovely little chat about music, and then we went into you being in the next best thing after Downton Abbey and giving out about the monarchy.
Listen,
so that's a great start with you this morning.
There's that stuff. It's it's a really weird one because you sort of turn up and a lot of the time you're just sat for hours and then someone shouts go and then you're playing and you might be in just a split second or something, but you and the lads have been playing, you know, on the set all day. And so it's weird. I don't really talk about it that much because I made the mistake of when I first did it, telling like my parents, oh, I'm going to be in this TV show. And then it was a real like blink and you'll miss me thing.
Yeah. People were sitting there looking out for you. And then they're like,
yeah,
I sat there watching that whole episode just to see Josh, and he wasn't even in it. Like, he was there for 2 seconds. Like,
yeah, you might see my foot on the hi-hat pedal, and that's like it.
Still though.
Still, pretty famous feet. But
exactly.
Yeah, so it's a weird one. So there's that stuff. But I do a bit of that. The theatre stuff's where I get my kicks from, really, though.
Yeah,
Yeah, well, I know that we're definitely going to get stuck into that, because that is in my own circle of music teachers here in Aberdeen, where it's a bit of a topic of conversation. So I'm definitely going to get stuck into that as we go on. But let's reverse back, and the second question I always ask after people getting people to, well, I suppose the first question I usually ask after asking people to introduce themselves is, I ask, where did music all start for you? So how did you get started?
I got started so in that weird time where you move from primary school to secondary school. And yeah. So what, you're 10, 11 years old, and there's a letter that gets sent home saying, does your child want to sign up to any musical instrument classes? I was just desperate to play the drums, and I didn't really know why. I wasn't aware at that stage of any drummers in my family, and it was just like, I really want to do it. So took my parents in signing me up to sort of group shared lessons, which is ridiculous. I think we got about 10 minutes each once a week.
Yeah.
But they were like, yeah, go on then. The whole thing was, oh, you don't need your own kit, and you just need a pair of sticks, so just come in and play on the school kit and it'll be great. So that was for me, really. I mean, before that, as a young kid, I was always interested in singing, and did a few bits and bobs of theatre then, like musical theatre stuff, as a kid. But yeah, my drumming was really secondary school.
Very good. And so you started those lessons. Did you eventually, like, I at the moment, my music school, we're trying to figure out how to do group drum lessons. And the only way that I can think about doing it is having a really big room with loads of drums in it. And just the same as you would any other thing. How did you find, this is probably not going to be, anyone listening to this, I'm sorry if you're not going to be interested in this part, but I'm really interested in this as like a customer survey almost. How did you find the group drum lessons? Did you find it helpful? Or did you find it more a hindrance? Did you then seek out one-to-one lessons, or what did you do?
Yeah, it lasted half a term, and then my drum teacher rang my parents and said he needs his own hour. Like, I think it's just a way of whittling out who's actually going to do it and who isn't, in a way. So it didn't last long for me. I was frustrated. Like, we took it. It was one kit in the room. Took it in turns to get on the kit, have, like, within half an hour. There was only three of us in there. But, yeah, like, it was just frustrating in a way, because you just cracked something and then it was someone else's go. And then you sat there drumming on your legs.
Yeah, I can imagine that was really annoying. So did you go through like grades or stuff, or grades or anything like that? Or what did you do?
Yeah, so my drum teacher, once I was into it doing my one-to-ones, he said, right, okay, what sort of drummer do you want to be? And I said, I want to play in bands. That's what I want to do. He went, okay. Mm-hmm. We could absolutely go through the grades, or I could teach you to be a band drummer, and we could just go through the fundamentals of what that means to play with other people. And I just went, yeah, of course, let's do that, as an 11-year-old, you know. Looking back now, it might be useful to have some grades under my belt. Well, I don't know, actually. But I love that he opened that to me and was just like, look, if that's what you want to do, let's not waste our time, you know.
Yeah.
Working out, well, time for tea.
Yeah, no, 100%. Well, look, I put it this way. I run a music school and I've not got a single grade to my name. I'm completely self-taught in every instrument that I play. So
amazing.
And it never really held me back. So I teach grades now, and there's an awful lot to be said for them. But they're at the very end of the day, they are a piece of paper that says you can play guitar, you can play drums, you can play whatever. Sure. Do you know what I mean? So being able to actually do the thing is far more important than the piece of paper that says that you can do it. So going through secondary school, you learned how to be a band drummer. When did you start your first band, or join your first band?
First band, I think probably 13 years old. And me and my friend Mark had heard about this bassist that was at another school. He was at the Swanky Boys school that was like down the road from us. And we were like, oh, what if he's a nightmare, though? Because he's at that clever lad school.
Yeah.
Anyway, we met up with him, and like, I don't know, someone introduced us whilst we were, Mark had this mad garden where we just used to like hang out all the time. And he had, you know, the classic shed with a kit in it and things like that.
Yes.
And it was like, yeah, let's meet up. This guy called Ed. And then we started that band. And we prepped for Battle of the Bands. We won Battle of the Bands, much to the older kids' sort of disgruntlement.
Yeah.
And then we actually carried on playing together, us three, until Well, until I was about 19, we ended up doing a couple of cool support tours. We supported Electric Six, did the O2 Academy with them, and we did Scouting for Girls back in the day, if anyone remembers them. Yeah, so it was quite nice, you know, old school friends sort of cracking on and doing it for a bit, you know. And yeah. Ed's gone on now to be an incredibly successful musician. He'd be a great person for you to chat to, actually. He is incredible. He not only does his own solo project, but plays for some amazing people as a session. And and Mark works in Absolute Music, one of the biggest guitar centers in the UK. So the boys have carried on in their own ways doing their thing, you know. But it's always a pleasure. Whenever we get a chance to meet up, we do little reunion gigs back at home, things like that.
I love that. That's absolutely fantastic. I don't know if I've ever come across anyone. I'm really trying to think that is still essentially, for all intents and purposes, in the band they start, their first band. Do you know what I mean?
Like I'd
be here all day trying to name the different bands that myself and my mates in school started way, way back when you're like 13, 14 and whatever else. And just within the space of 1 year, I could have been in 10 different bands. Do you know what I mean? And I'm still like myself and the boys from, I live in Scotland, myself and the boys that I was in a band with, one of them still lives at home and the other one lives in Qatar now. And we never really officially broke up as a band. Anytime we're together, it's very, very, very seldom that we're all together. But anytime we are, we try and do a gig together. But that wasn't until we were like 17. We were like pretty much adults at that stage. So that's lovely to hear that you're pretty much still involved in the band that you started when you were 13 and you went
absolutely,
on
to do yeah, really cool it's things. Great.
That's so cool.
It's great.
What was the name of the band?
Mutant Vinyl.
Mutant Vinyl.
That's right.
That's absolutely fantastic. Great stuff.
Ridiculous. Ooh. Yeah.
Yeah, it's mental. It sounds like a Brewdog beer nowadays.
It does, doesn't it, actually? Yeah. Oh, you would say that. Yeah. You're Aberdeen-based, right?
I am Aberdeen-based, yeah. So you obviously know about Brewdog.
Well, yeah. So I was in Aberdeen with the tour about 4 weeks ago, I think. It's a shame that we didn't connect before that. I could have come and met you. Yeah, yeah. We were at His Majesty's Theatre for a week. Yeah.
No way. Jez, there you go.
Yeah, so I spent a lot of time touring around the different Brewdogs.
Yeah. Yeah. You didn't by any chance try the Black Heart, the new take on it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What do you think?
It's not, you can't compare it to Guinness. It's a completely different thing. It's sweet. It's thick. It's not.
It's just.
I hate all the branding they've done where they're like, I don't know if you saw on Twitter, they went to Guinness Gate and they held it up. Oh, awful.
Yeah. I'm a big Brewdog fan and I'm a big fan of beer in general, but I'm also a big fan of Guinness. And not being like a gatekeeper about it, like I was really, really open to it because they used to have Jet Black Heart, which was fantastic. Yeah. It was so tasty. And then they changed
that.
That was fantastic. And then they brought out Black Heart and I was kind of like, you're just making an absolute holy show of yourselves trying to compete with Guinness. And I'm not being a gatekeeper. I'm not just being plastic patty about it. I'm genuinely not.
You know I completely agree. I completely agree.
Yeah. Well, look, the next time you're in Aberdeen, we'll definitely get a couple of pints into us, 100%. That'll have to happen. Anyway, there's a second segue. This is turning into a great little episode. We've been going on about politics and monarchy. Now we're talking about pints. This is fucking great. So anyway, back to you were playing away with Mutant Vinyl when you were up until about 18, 19, thereabouts. When, like, what was the end goal when you were in school? Like, did you want to grow up and be the drummer for Mutant Vinyl, or did you want to grow up and be, what did you want to be? What was the plan?
Yeah, it was a tricky one. I went through phases. So I've always, from a young age, I remember just being like, right, I'm going to be an actor. My mum works an actress as well. And I'd sort of grown up with that around. And I was like, well, that's what I'm going to do. And then the more and more I started playing drums, I kind of lent into thinking, you know what, actually, I want to just go and tear up festival stages and be a drummer, you know. So it was odd. I sort of fluctuated between the two. And it was only really when I got to 18 and I ended up getting into drama school. And I was like, right, I'm going to go train, be an actor now. And the drums will be what I do for fun, you know. It didn't really happen. I carried on working as a drummer whilst I was at drama school. In fact, some of these gigs I did with Mutant Vinyl were things like I would drive after finishing college to whichever O2 Academy we were playing at, and then do the gig and then drive back through the night and make it in at 8 a.m. sort of bleary eyed and not tell anyone what I was doing. But and then, as I said, after I graduated, I just, I suddenly, my first audition after leaving drama school was for the Blue Man Group. I don't know if you know them.
I think they do a thing in Disney or in Universal in the States.
That's
and stuff
right.
like that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so drumming blue clowns, basically. And and I was like, hang on a minute. There's like this whole world of performing as well as playing the drums. And and then it just carried on from there, really. So there was definitely a time at school, I'd say 16, where I was like, yeah, come on. Got to keep wearing my skinny jeans and being a rock star.
Yeah.
And then that disappeared for a bit. And then I try and merge the two as much as possible now, which is good.
Yeah. So what was your first job then as like I'd imagine you kind of, as most actors, musicians, creative people do, when you're starting out, you look for anything you can get and you take whatever you can get and you're just like, right, this is grand. This will keep me going. This might not be forever. But what was the first job that you got that you were kind of, right, this is now my niche. This is now my area of expertise. I am an acting drummer. Or a drumming actor.
Yeah. So I did a show called The Blonde Bombshells in 1943, which is also a famous film of it with Judi Dench in it. But it's a story of a group of women during World War II in 1943 who decide they need to bring music back because all of the men that have gone off to war were playing all the local gigs and things like that. And all the jazz bands had disappeared. And so they were sort of, like a WI group. And they went, right, we need to put a band together. We're going to start doing some, bring back some music for morale. Mm. And so it's a story of eight women in that. And then my character, Patrick, comes in and it's like, hey, I'm here to audition for the band. And they're like, well, no, it's an all female band. It's like, well, what do you wear on stage during the gigs? It's like, well, we wear blonde wigs and pink dresses. He's like, ah, cool, no problem. And they're like, what? Anyway, he auditions, plays, and he's a bit of a snake of a character. He basically is doing it to avoid signing up. He's sort of a big cowardly character. But the drumming in it was great. There's loads of Glenn Miller stuff and, big band, old 40s jazz. And
cool.
I was playing that with these eight fantastic actor musician women who are just like mind-blowingly talented. And that was, that was 2014, I think. And I just went, okay. Great,
cool, and then the rest is history, as I say. And you've been doing that since.
Yeah, just shows where they need drummers
that's
and actors.
Class. Yeah, that's class. That must be really hard. Like when you were saying about like that kind of 40s big band style, the first thing I thought of was the film Whiplash.
So
it must be like quite intense stuff along those lines, is it?
It was. Yeah, I mean, not quite as intense as the stuff that's played in that. I had to really nail into my brushwork. This is the interesting thing about being an actor musician, is that you play different parts from different time periods, and a lot of the time you're playing real drummers as well, so you need to study different styles. So it's very rare that I just play as me, if that makes sense.
If
I'm sat at a kit, I grew up just trying to be like Chad Smith, so I'm very much of that kind of sit upright, let's go big, hi-hat's always moving, but actually it doesn't work for so many other styles. And so I had to really nail in my brushwork, work really hard on all of that. But again, you leave that job with a wealth of new skill that you can then go on to the next. Like the next thing I was doing was a 50s thing. And so it then was like, oh, okay, I can see how 50s rock and roll drumming is that weird in between jazz kind of shuffle. It's not quite a shuffle, but it's not quite straight. And you can, you load up your toolbox with stuff every job to make sure that you're playing accurately.
Cool. Ah, that's so interesting, because I often wonder. I'm exactly the same as you in terms of guitar. I grew up playing like Van Halen and all that sort of stuff. And then my first real job was playing in Irish pubs in Spain. And I didn't know any Irish songs. I was playing acoustic guitar. I didn't know any Irish songs, and I was just kind of like, but sure, I'm a class guitar player. I can play all the Van Halen stuff. It's four chord shite. It's simple, and it's not. It's not. It really is. It's like what you're saying. You really have to learn the style, and then it makes you a better musician for it. And you leave that job, and you go on to the next one with a wealth of new skills that you never realized that you needed or were going to ever or had any real intention of doing. So that's at such a really, really cool point. What were some of the cooler things that you'd done? You must have done something, like obviously that 40s thing was class, that 50s thing was class, but did you ever do anything that was like completely mental and off the wall?
Yeah, I've done a few things. It's funny, I've not thought about this job for a while until you've asked that question.
Yeah.
But there was a play called Little One by a Canadian writer, and it was part of the Canadian Theatre Festival that happens in London. Massive thing. Right. Happens every year. And the director brought me in, and the idea was it's just two people in this play, and he wanted a drum kit sat in the middle and to live narrate the soundtrack for the entire play based on what the energy the actors were giving, like throughout their dialogue and conversations. It was wild. It was mad. It was one of the most creative things I've ever done.
Yeah. So were you sort of like, the terminology has left me, like the main character, for lack of a better term?
No. So I was essentially a third character. So any time that sound got mentioned, there was a whole scene. You didn't know what was going on next door, but there was a lot of noise that was referred to next door, and so it's about like finding ways of creating that sound on the kit. So not a load of conventional playing. There wasn't a load of just sitting down and playing beats. It was a lot more kind of expressive stuff, and and just building. So there's a couple of really heated scenes between the two actors, and you work out how you maybe settle into a rhythm going across the kit and build it and bubble along with them. So I was creating a soundtrack live in the moment that wasn't ever the same. So no two shows were ever the same, because the actors were so impulsive that I just had to be locked in with both of them. So it felt like you didn't breathe for like 2 hours. You got to the end, took your bow, and you were like, Jesus, that's a lot.
Yeah, that's really, really creative. I think I got it initially when you said it, but I think I got it now. That's really, really interesting. That's so cool. In terms of like, let's talk about the practical side of doing that sort of theatre work. So, as an actor, let's take the current show that you're in, the Buddy Holly story. What character do you play in the Buddy Holly story?
So I play Jerry Allison, who was Buddy's drummer and best friend. And it's a really nice supporting role. And obviously, well, most people know the music of Buddy Holly. It's it's got a solid fan base. So feel pretty fortunate to be, you know, recreating an amazing, you know, very short-lived career. But it's the power of a lot of his songs went on to inspire so many artists that everyone else sort of loves today. It's an amazing show. I've actually been doing this show on and off since 2016. They're very kind, and they keep having me back, which is very nice. But
good stuff.
Yeah, love it.
Good stuff. So you as Jerry, then what is your input in the show? Have you got speaking lines? Have you got like all that sort of stuff? So
if you imagine it as so we don't really call it a musical. Sometimes the marketing says Buddy the Musical, but it's not really, because the music isn't used to emote. So like in musical theater, for example, when the whole point of people singing in musical theater is when emotions get too high to speak, you then go into song, right?
Yeah.
Whereas this, we're essentially doing the play of Buddy Holly's life.
Yeah.
And in that play, you see him making music. So at the start of the show, we play at the KDAV Sunday Country Party, which is very much like, so when we start the show, Buddy and the boys are like 18 years old. They're still, you know, they're not big yet or anything. They're dressed up in their little country outfits. They've been invited to play at this KDAV party broadcast on the radio. And they play about 16 bars of a country song, Flower in My Heart, which there is a recording of Buddy actually doing this. And then they flip into Rip It Up and they play rock and roll, which was not okay. This is 1957. Everyone's unhappy about these three white guys suddenly playing music that is not for them to be playing, especially in Texas, in Lubbock, like... and then basically the play, we go on to tell the story of how Buddy then goes to Decca and he goes and records That'll Be the Day there, and they say, that's the worst song we've ever heard, we're not doing
that.
Yeah. Imagine. And so it's like, well, this is not working. Then they go to Clovis, New Mexico, and they meet the producer Norman Petty, who sort of goes, right, okay, let's record the music the way you want to do it. And they re-record That'll Be the Day there. They do Peggy Sue there. They do Not Fade Away. And so, yeah, you then see the progression of the band. So I'm acting in it. I'm playing Jerry Anderson. So I say all the lines, but then I'm also doing all of his drumming as well.
Yeah. Cool. That's so interesting. I'm ashamed to say I don't actually really know the story of Buddy Holly too much, other than the plane crash and all that kind of jazz. But it was a plane crash, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah. Plane crash during a concert tour that he was doing with Richie Valens and the Big Bopper.
That's right. It was Richie Valens. Yeah. What I was trying to get at there was the practical side of things. So me, as someone that's not in the musical theater world, but as a musician, I know what goes into actually performing at a gig, a show, a concert, or whatever way you want to frame it. So me, and I also play drums, so I also know what goes into doing that sort of thing. But I don't know what goes into like the actor and the acting sort of thing, bar what I've seen. So in my head, I'm thinking for the acting side of things, you've got like costume changes, you've got, I'd imagine a host of other things. And as a musician, you've got things, practical things along the lines of like, if you break a drumstick, do you need to sound check, or how do you sound check, and all that kind of crack. So what I'm trying to ask is, how do I even fucking...
I think I know what you're getting at. So
Do you know what I'm trying to ask? Yeah.
So we're touring weekly at the moment, right? It's a 42-week tour, I think. It's a big boy tour most of this year. I'll talk to you like about my day, which I'm about... So after I finish chatting to you today, I'm driving to our next theatre, which we're at for the rest of the week.
Right.
So I'll get to the theatre.
Yeah.
I'll then nip in. That we have an entire like tech crew that will have been building the set and everything. All of the costume department will have been getting everything ready. And so then first thing I do when I go in is just go and check, like the kit will be in situ. But because we've got great sound team on it who set everything up, but I always like to do my own little tweaks. You know, every drummer, you know, it doesn't matter. Yep. I've had some great drum techs in the past, but actually it's great to go in and just check everything, because 100%. Sometimes things aren't quite same. So I do that, and then we go and warm up. So our choreographer leads like a physical warm up, which is a lot of stretches and stuff based as all of us as musicians in the show. So we get physically warm for it. And then there's a vocal warm up led by our touring MD, because we do a lot of singing in the show as well. And then we go into sound check. So by that point, so usually that's in another room, sort of like studio theater, maybe on the side. Then we go into the main house. Everything's ready to go. And then we go through with our sound number one, we do a sound check. So that will be very much like a normal gig where, you know, we'll start off with the kit. We'll go round. We'll make sure everything sounded great with that. And then we do bass, guitars. What do we have on the show? We have two saxes, trumpet, a whole load of BVs, two keys. So yeah, it's quite a big operation.
Big production, yeah.
And then we just sort of top and tail. There's a few. So the end of the show is a 45-minute concert, which was Buddy's last concert before he got on the plane and passed away in the crash. We recreate his last concert. We top and tail some of the big numbers in that. And then we nip into, and then like quite a lot of the others get released, and then the core four bands that are telling the story of the Crickets, we then go through, because in different scene changes, the drum kit's in different positions, and you know, we have different monitoring. It's really good, actually. Me and the bassist on this tour and the guitarist are all on IEMs, which I've done this tour without IEMs, just monitors before. And you're in different theaters every week, moving positions, and it's hard. You know, stage falling gets outrageous. So yeah, we finished in sound check around 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
Then it will be into... Well, some terrible meal deal from Tesco, probably. That's the touring way.
Yeah.
And then into the dressing room, and, you know, 1950s. So get shaves, get the hair all done, get that back, get the first costume on. I think I wear about 8 costumes throughout the show. So there's loads of quick changes.
Yeah.
But we've got our radio mics, which we have to wear. So you feel a bit like a cyborg, because you've got a radio mic on your back. You've also got your IEM pack on your back. And on sort of a belt round you, so you've got all your stuff plugged in. And then, show's at 7:30. We start the show. And finish up around 10:30. And that is the average day of... No, that's a get-in day, you know. And then tomorrow we have two shows. So we have a matinee and an evening. So.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty much answered my question. What I was trying to get at was, I was, as someone that wouldn't be as in the know as, like, I am not in the know. I'm more in the know than someone who definitely isn't in the know, but someone that definitely isn't in the know might be thinking, I might, like, the Josh Haberfield out there in the world somewhere that's wanting to be and do what you're doing, but they're thinking, oh God, that's such a big long list of things for me to think about. God, I have to make sure my hi-hat is set right before every gig, and I need to think about, like, a change in costumes, I need to think about my lines and all that kind of crack. So it's nice to have just gone through exactly what an average day is like. And I suppose then, like you're saying, that's the sort of a load-in day. Is every day then going to be as intense as that? Are you going to do a sound check every day and all that kind of crack? Probably not as much.
No, so, you know, ideally, because we've spent the time on a load-in day doing the sound check, levels shouldn't really change for the rest of the week. Now, all musicians know that that's not always the case.
Exactly, yeah.
There are so many mystery gremlins in sound equipment that, like, stuff happens. Yeah. So we might have to come in and touch up. But no, mainly we, that's the most intense day. And then sometimes we have two show days. I think I drum about 35 songs in the show. A lot of it's like fast rock and roll, so it's a bit relentless. So those two show days, you're definitely feeling it by the end of the day. You're going, yeah. Oh, okay.
That's a lot of drumming. That's an awful lot of drumming. Like,
it's a lot of drumming, but there's something so strange about it. If you went and did a, you know, I used to do an awful lot of function stuff, and I do a lot of function stuff when I'm not in acting work. It's lovely sort of other work to go and do. If you go and do 35 songs at a wedding or something, you don't really think much of it. You're like, actually.
No, you don't. Know, like, to be fair.
Just get it done and that's fine. But yeah, there's something about the energy you have to bring being on stage. Jerry's drumming as well is erratic. He's so fluid. He moves a lot more from the core than I would do normally. I'd normally sit quite still. But actually, there's this fluidity to him I want to emulate. There's so many old black and white videos that I've just like studied to make sure I get it down. And it's nice because, you know, people pick up on it. People who come to see the show, fans go, all right, you know, God, it really looked like watching Jerry up there. That's amazing to get that, you know.
Yeah, that's great that you go into such detail. I know myself, anyone that I'm into, like, we'll take Van Halen. I know exactly, like, you could have taken Eddie Van Halen's hands and put it on any guitar in the world, and I'd be like, Eddie Van Halen.
Yeah,
so
nice.
Anyone that's into Buddy Holly in the same way, and that's into, like, your character Jerry, they would know it. They'd recognize that and they'd really appreciate it. It was like, he's not just taking the paycheck. Like, he's properly putting the I suppose you've been at it for a while now at this stage.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, things that, it's funny. So I was touring with this when, we won't delve in COVID too long because that seems to be the most musician chat ever. But when COVID hit, I was on the road with it and we still had 7 months left of a tour. And it was weird. Just like, one day turning up to the theater and them saying, oh, you might want to take your stuff because we're not sure if we're coming back in tomorrow. And you're just like, right.
Yeah.
Okay. And we thought, it will last a couple of weeks. We'll be back. And obviously we weren't. But it, so this tour, didn't start until, when did we start this? February. We started rehearsals for this tour. And so it took that long to get a tour like rebooked and back in. So it's kind of like a weird continuation. But on this tour, I was like, right, if I'm doing it again, I want to make it the most accurate thing possible. So I got in contact with Ludwig Drums that Jerry used to play. And I said, hey, I'm doing this. And it would be really good to get a kit that's going to be strong enough to withstand, you know, 8 shows a week and touring around, but also is the truest sort of replica to what Jerry played. And they just were over the moon that I got in contact. They've been incredible. They've taken me on as an artist and helped design this kit that's just like, it feels like a proper tribute to Jerry. You know, I love playing it. Every single show I get on it and I'm just like, oh, it sounds perfect for this music.
That's amazing. You just need to make sure now that any other job you take on that the drummer plays Ludwig.
I know, right? Yeah. Well, yeah. So I have to do the Beatles musical next. That'd be fine.
Was Ringo on Ludwig, was he?
He certainly was. You must know Ringo. That.
I know that Alex Van Halen was on
Ludwig. Fair. Yeah. But yeah, so just things like that that make you go, I've got to make sure that this is the thing, you know. It's got to be right.
Yeah.
Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, 100%. Couldn't agree with you more. Could not agree with you more. So in terms of then what else you've done in your career, you've also done things along the lines of like cruise ships and stuff. Was that, did you do the cruise ships just like in between theaters, or is there sort of two sides to you? Well, three sides to you, I suppose, along with the acting and stuff.
Yeah, so the cruise ship stuff came about because there was a group of lads.
That's a great start to a story. Always, that's the best start. There was a group of lads.
That's a group of lads, yeah.
And it's always going to be good.
So this group of lads were the year below me at drama school, and they had formed like a 5-part harmony vocal group doing sort of quite a lot of like Carole King stuff and some other Motown stuff. And they had this audition for cruise ships, but they wanted a band behind them to look like the real deal, you know.
Yeah.
And me and my friends had set up a rock and roll band, just playing 50s and 60s tunes at functions, in pubs, like nothing glamorous at all. Just we enjoyed that music, and there was a market for it. It always gets booked, you know, rock and roll. People like it. So, they asked us. So us four went down to Southampton to go and play backup for this vocal group. And whilst we were there, we were just playing their 20-minute little slot at the showcase thing that, you know, all the artists go and audition for ships. And someone had dropped out. And so Steve, who's the lead singer of the rock and roll band, the Runaround Kids, was like, we could do a little bit. I was like, well, yeah, all right. So what should we do?
Yeah.
He was like, we'll just play some rock and roll. We'll just tell some of the bad jokes we do at like pub gigs. I was like, yeah, all right, fine. So we told the organizer, and they went, yeah, go on then, if you're sure. Looks better than having a hole in the middle of the showcase. So we did. Yeah. And I think out of like 10 acts, we were the only ones that got booked from that showcase. No, so even the lads that we were backing up didn't get booked.
No way.
Yeah, so it was a bit like, oh God. Anyway, it was a quick start. So basically, yeah, we were auditioning for guest entertainer work. That, for anyone that's unfamiliar with that term, it basically means you're not like onboard musicians, because those guys are hardcore. They're amazing. The guest entertaining jobs are like a glorified holiday, because you get flown onto the ship. You might do a week on board, and you might do two shows in that time you're on board, and the rest of the time you're a guest, basically. So it really is like,
I love that. I'd love that. I couldn't be arsed now with the whole 6 months away and all that kind of crack. That wouldn't suit me. But yeah, a holiday and just doing some class gigs and having the crack. That sounds like great. That just sounds fantastic now.
It's fab, you know, like it really is amazing. But we had no idea what we were getting into, really. So they just said, oh, you've got to have two theatre shows sorted. So Steve and I met up and went for a few coffees, sort of for a good couple of weeks solid. And put together this show that was, it was a load of good rock and roll tunes that everyone knew. Elvis, Beatles, Buddy Holly, that kind of stuff, Eddie Cochran. And in between, just a load of really bad gags. But, you know, fun stuff that everyone groans at. And we were like, we think this will work. I think this will be all right. Anyway, off we went. And it went really well. And so that band is still out now. Well, that's gone from four of us to there's now a group of about 30 of us that exist as Runaround Kids. And at the moment, there's a band out on Seabourn Cruise Lines, which is like 6-star luxury, amazing. There's a band out on Holland America. There's about to be another band out on P&O. It's just blown up into this thing, which is just basically all of our mates now. We've got together and gone, if you're not in work and you fancy a trip away, you want to go and play some rock and roll and get paid and have a couple of weeks on a ship, this is it. So yeah, that's amazing. I'm super proud of that. And I sort of stepped away from the organization point of view, and a chap, Andrew, came in and is managing it. But I'm always there as a sort of sounding board for them now. They've got stuff coming up, I still go and play whenever I fancy it. They're very kind. They give me first refusal on stuff as a OG, you know. So
brilliant, yeah.
It's a great world. I feel very fortunate that we tapped into it. I visited, I think one year, I visited 26 countries in one year for work. And it's like places I would never dream of getting to or going.
Where was one of the standout places?
So a couple for you. So I guess like mad that you never think you'd end up in. We did this whole cruise that took us round Central, South America, went through the Panama Canal. We were in Colombia, Mexico, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Costa Rica. You know, you're just like, how? And the whole time, we're being paid just to play a couple of gigs. Amazing, you know.
Yeah, that's so cool. Over this end of the world, exotic is like a week in Alicante. Do you know
that's
what I mean?
That's it, exactly, yeah. And I had, like, I'd done a couple of jobs where I traveled around Europe before, but I never had the opportunity to get out. So yeah, I've been like all over America as well with it. And I mean, the Caribbean during the winter, you can pop off and string a couple of ships together. And, you know, before you know it, you've survived winter in the Caribbean and you've come back to England with a lovely tan in January, ready to start your next contract. And you're like, it's not bad. It's not bad.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Do you know what I love about that is that when you're not on the inside of that sort of, when you're not in that sort of world, but you're desperate to get into it, there's this whole, because I know from my own experience, there's this whole like air of mystery as to like, oh, how have these lads figured out how to get onto cruise ships? How have they figured out to like all this sort of stuff? And it's like, it's almost black magic for people that are trying to start out gigging and trying to actually break into making music their full-time thing. But you're just sitting here being like, oh yeah, it's just myself and a group of lads and we just sort of just met at work and it just happened that way. It's nice to know that it is very accessible and that it literally can just start as something as simple as that. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It isn't all just like big wigs and suits just like pulling strings and what or whatever people might think that is going on the back end, if you get me.
Yeah, totally. We had to, because we hit it like quite green, we weren't sure really what was going on. We got picked up by an agent that was then, because we just started working for one English cruise line, we were just working for P&O at the start, and then we had an agent pick us up and say, oh, you know, I'm going to put you across all these different ships. And actually, what I'd say to anyone that is getting into it and sort of repping themselves doing it, which is totally the right way to go if you can, I mean, having an agent opens doors, of course, but for the cruise world, if you can be in complete control of what you're doing, where you're going, and the work you're putting out, I just think it's really important to hold on to that, because you can end up doing stuff that maybe you're like, I'm not overly proud of that. Whereas what we've always maintained with this band is that we're really proud of the stuff that we put out. But yeah, we actually end up losing our agent and carrying on just doing it ourselves, because we realized quite quickly that was the charm of it. I think that it was just, especially the American market, we've been really fortunate that American cruise lines really like having four British lads come on and be a bit silly, because it, you know, we lean into that. We lean into the sort of stereotype of the Beatles going to America and, you know, everyone just having a bit of a laugh and being sarcastic. And
Americans love that sort of stuff.
Us
over in this end of the world, we are our own greatest export. Do you know what I mean? It's a fantastic thing to go over to, because I've gigged in America as well. And like, I'm not saying that I'm any use. I'm not terrible. I'm perfectly adequate and functional.
Come on.
I can perform. Do you know what I mean? I can perform. I can do my job. But people love it. People can't get enough. Oh my God, you're Irish. Oh my great fucking whoever was new an Irish
guy. Yeah, of course.
And then they're all half Irish, they're half Scottish, they're half English. By the time they're done, there's no American left in them. Do you know what I mean? And all this kind of crack. And they love it. They can't get enough of us over this end of the world, over there end of the world. They can't get enough of it, and that's fantastic. So if you had to, let's try and so you gave a bit of advice there to like try and keep it all as in-house as possible and to really maintain it and be proud of it. And that's fantastic. But if you were to go even a little bit further and to reverse engineer what you eventually ended up doing, if you had to do that again, and you had to advise someone how to do that and how to get into that and break into that and get to where you eventually got to, what would be the first thing that they would have to do?
The first thing I would say is work out what your USP is. Work out what you're doing differently, because if you want to go and work on a cruise ship, they're already full of amazing musicians.
Yep.
So like the onboard people are incredible. And some of these huge ships as well have an orchestra. They have... then like a jazz trio and a rock band and a soul band and then like a party function band. So there's already like, what, six bands already on the ship.
Yeah.
So if you're going on as a band, you've got to work out what your thing is. So ours was making sure we played, you know, really accurate rock and roll so that it was stylized as opposed to us just playing songs. So it wasn't, you know, you might walk around the shift and you might hear Johnny Be Good three times in a day, sure, because it's a popular song and everyone loves it and it's a function classic. But we were like, right, let's make sure we're doing it right and with exactly the right grooves. So yeah, but then also just working out. So our thing was the whole British humor thing, ridiculous sort of self-deprecating jokes. And also just making sure on stage, you see so many people taking themselves a bit seriously, which is fine. Like, it's good to take yourself seriously. But our thing was take ourselves seriously behind closed doors and be all business, getting ourselves to the point where we walk out on stage. And then once we're on stage, the professionalism, the slickness is there. It's so rehearsed, but it looks like off the cuff in the moment.
Yeah.
Boys having a laugh together. So yeah, I think my one thing would be work out what you can offer that none of the other groups that are already on ships can do.
Yeah.
You need to have unlocked.
Yeah. And anyone thinking that's how do I work out my USP, unique selling point, is it doesn't have to be anything. You don't have to reinvent the wheel with it. It can be something as simple as just like what you're saying, find your niche. If your niche is rock and roll, make sure you're getting it right. If your niche is like what my niche would be in like Irish music and stuff like that, just make sure that you, something as simple as singing in an Irish accent and not putting on an accent when you're singing can be your unique selling point. Do you know what I mean? I can't tell you the amount of Irish bands that I see going around the world singing in an American accent, and they talk like me. It blows my mind. I don't understand why people do it. But anyway, that's a discussion for another day. But something as arbitrary as that can be your USP. What do you think? Do you think so?
100%. Yeah. It doesn't have to be big. It's just and stick to it. You know, stick to your guns.
Yes.
I think there's people love to offer people advice, whether they're in this industry or not. That is the one thing. Yeah. All performers, you have people come up to you in the bar afterwards or whatever, and they might start a conversation by going, yeah, great show, loved it. And then by, you know, a couple more sentences in, they're saying, have you ever thought about trying? And, you know, you're polite and you go, thanks so much for your feedback, that's great. But actually, you walk away from that conversation, you should believe in what you're doing even more. You should go, well, I definitely don't want to do what they just suggested, so I'm going to crack on and keep doing this.
Exactly. If you're a self-employed bricky, bricklayer, why would you take advice from
me? Imagine, I walk out and go, lovely wall building, mate. This is looking great. But I was just wondering, have you tried doing it on an angle? That might be cool.
That might be cool. Exactly. Yeah. So why should you as a musician? We always have, us musicians we're a funny old bunch, because we always have imposter syndrome in the background of Everton, being like, oh well, Jesus, Jim there, he knows an awful lot about an awful lot. Jesus, maybe the way I am doing it is completely wrong. Well, if Jim says, oh fuck, the whole thing's gone. Do you know what I mean? Like,
totally. So, imposter syndrome is so common.
It's so common. But just as you say, let it drive you on. And on a like, so that's, I think that's fantastic advice to have your USP kind of locked in and have exact and know who you are so that you can sell yourself. Who do you need to then speak to get into any of these cruise ships or even any of these theater shows? Or like, do you know what I mean? What's the first step to actually getting on board with one of these things?
Yeah, so I know I was bad mouthing big agents earlier, but if you have representation, that's always going to open doors, right? You don't necessarily have to stick with that representation. Like, so for me at the moment, my personal agent, sadly had to close up her business during COVID, like so many others. So she was really sorry, and she's like, I can introduce you to some other agents and stuff. And I thought, you know what, like, it's all good. And actually during COVID, I thought I could do the whole online recording stuff, and I did a little bit of that, but actually I ended up retraining as a paddleboarding instructor and worked most of COVID outdoors paddleboarding, which was lovely. And and it was a complete move away. But then when theatre started opening back up and ships started happening again, I went, right, I know enough people now. I've got my network where I don't need an agent, and I've booked a lot of work myself, which is great. But I wouldn't have met those people without having an agent in the first place.
Yeah.
You know? So if you want to, the two things are quite different. I think if you're wanting to do the cruise ship guest entertainer thing, take, you're in a band and you're like, right, we've written this show, we want to put this on. Then you need to look at who, you can easily Google it. Just who is, who's the talent booker for what cruise line? And then they always have things where you can apply to go and play at the showcases, like the one I mentioned earlier. And it's as easy as that. What we found really helped us get in the door, especially with the big American ships, which do pay better, is having an amazing promo video.
Okay. So that, probably worth throwing a couple of quid into getting a promo video.
100%. And, you know, calling all the favors. I've got some like dear, dear friends that run a media company that have helped me out in every angle of my career. They're amazing. But yeah, pull in any favors, rent a space, get all of your friends in to be the most supportive audience ever. Get some Vox Pops after the show and get them to gush about how great it was. You know, at the end of the day, some booker in Miami isn't going to know that it's your mum and dad talking about how great the drama was. So yeah, I'd say that's always really important. In the acting world, it's changed a little bit actually since COVID, which is really nice. I think it's slightly more accessible. There's a lot of castings that now don't just go straight through agents. Because it used to be a casting director would have their pool of agents that they liked working with. They would get in contact with those agents and they would say, right, who have you got for me for this role? They need to be able to sing, drum, act, look like this person. Great. Oh yeah, Josh will do. Get him in for an audition.
Yeah.
Because actually now there's a lot more stuff going out on Twitter. If you follow casting directors, they will put those briefs out there and they'll say, if you think you're right for this, get in contact. Because they know so many people, like so many agents left the industry and so many people were left unrepresented. But I really like there's, you know, there's a bit more of a world now of if you think you're right for a job, or if you, so if, example, if you go and see the Buddy Holly story, if you come and watch it and you go, oh, you know what? I could play Buddy Holly in that. I could do that. Hmm. Get online, go to the contact on the website and just write to them and send them your stuff because they will see you. Like, they will see that person, whether you end up getting a job or not, I don't know. But if you believe in yourself enough to go, I can do that, and you send them some material that shows you can do that, you will get a shot.
Very good. Well, hopefully you've not just put yourself out of a job because someone else is going to look more like Jerry Allison than you.
Listen, it might happen, and that's okay. That's how it works. It swings and roundabouts.
Well, I think that's some really, really good and solid advice. So if you're out there listening and you've resonated with that, stop what you're doing right now and go and act on it. Just go, see what I did there. Go and act
on it. Yeah, Barry. Very good.
I tell you what, see, I could do one of these shows. Anyway, I'm going to
get you on the cruise ships.
I'm going to send an email right now. Hey, I'm a better Josh Haberfield than Josh is. Give me his job, grand job. As I said, go and act on it right now. Go and get it done. Send the first email. You'll have to send 100 before you get one back, but it's always worth sending the first one and getting the ball rolling. Josh, before we finish up here now, is there anything that you're working on or what's the next steps or what's the crack?
Next steps? Well, yeah, so I'm on Buddy until mid-October. So yeah, if anyone's in the UK and they fancy coming and seeing the show, who are a part of your listeners, do get in touch. You can find me on Instagram and let me know. And I'm normally able to get ticket deals and things like that. So if you're a musician, you want to come and watch it, then or anything, if you're, you know, one of Barry's listeners, do get in contact with me and say hello, and we could at least grab a quick hello at stage door afterwards or whatever. But yeah, so I'm doing that. And then what am I doing? Well, next year, actually, I'm going to be back on tour in a purely acting role just for a little bit in a play called The Importance of Being Ernest, which is a production The Importance of Being Ernest, where Ernest doesn't turn up, and so we end up casting a random member of the audience to play the lead role for the entire show. So that's a riot.
Someone from the audience has gone along to see this and doesn't know that they're going to be in the show.
Yeah And then they end up playing the lead part. It's wild. Class. So I've got that in the bank. But then I've also got some stuff. I was really lucky last year. I got to Depp on a gig for Albert Lee. I don't know if you know the legend.
Yeah, country guitar player.
Yeah. So Albert is 79 years old, still going strong, still gigging loads. And he actually took over when Buddy dies. He took over playing in the crickets. So he's a legit real life cricket alumni, and through the Buddy Holly story, my connections there, he was like best friends with Jerry Allison. Jerry Allison only sadly died last year, and I'm so gutted I never got to meet him. But one of the things happen through that is Albert was doing some work that Jerry was going to be in the UK. He was going to do some drumming for. Jerry wasn't there, so I ended up being recommended. And so I went and drummed for Albert. And it was, you know, incredible. It was a real pinch me moment. I was there playing songs that I've been playing for years, but with the real deal, you know. So it's like, but so Albert's doing some more touring and I'm jumping on some gigs with him as and when I can.
Cool.
Just like such a pleasure to, he's one of those people that you just watch and you're like, oh, okay. You know, legends that we need to jump at any chance to play with.
Absolutely. They're absolutely. That's class. That's so cool. That's so, so cool. Great. Well, look, I wish you the absolute best of luck with that. And I'm looking forward to hearing all about it. We'll have to get you back on this time next year to chat all about that and tell us all the stories about Albert Lee. Because I'd imagine he's still 79 means nothing. Like, do you know what I mean? He's still probably
he's an incredible
rock star. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you put a guitar around his neck. He's very quiet, very reserved. Put a guitar around his neck. He's wild. Absolutely. And I mean, so we're up in, where are we near you? I come to Inverness in the summer, actually. So if you fancy a little
in Inverness in the summer?
To Inverness. Yeah. Come and see the show. 100%. Let me know.
I will. That'd be good. I certainly will. Yeah, I'll take a guitar with me and sure, I don't know. I'll just take a guitar with me and look like a pleb when no one wants
absolutely.
To do
that. Just come
across. Well, tell you what, let's finish off here with a very quick fire round. As I always say, these are like kind of icebreakers at the end. Just because you know yourself. Cool. So, question one: tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Good man. Now I had this question in here for a guest last week that was Irish and had written in Tato or King, but that doesn't really for crisps. Just in case you didn't know that.
Oh, I got and it. I got it.
You got it, have you?
Yeah.
Which one, Tato or King?
Tato.
Tato. Correct. Yeah. Good man.
Sure. I was shooting in Belfast for like 2 months last year on a TV show and. The catering was full of taters. There was, you know, packets of them flying around everywhere.
Can't bear a tato, lad. It is a well-known and undisputed fact that tato are unbeatable. It's just a fact. And there you go. Anyway, now here's an interesting one for you. I've asked this to a lot of people, but I think this is going to be really interesting for you. If you could live in any era, which would you choose and why? Bearing in mind now that you have played people from millions of eras.
60s,
yeah. Why 60s?
Imagine being in the 60s Liverpool like beat scene coming up and being in that like underground cabin scene playing in bands then. Oh, be great,
that'd be class. You get to go to Woodstock,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That'd be class. Cool. Right, tell you what, let's do one more. This has turned into my absolute favorite question over every and believe it or not, the first one I ever asked was Leilani, our mutual friend. I asked her this.
Right.
This was the first time I ever asked this question. What celebrity would you like to fight?
I remember hearing this on Leilani's episode. My goodness. She said someone really funny, didn't she?
She said Christopher Walken.
Christopher Walken. Bless him. Sweet. What celebrity would like to fight? Jack Whitehall.
Oh yes. Why Jack Whitehall?
Oh, I just find him infuriating.
This is the first time that this could actually be possible because you live in London and I'm going to guess Jack Whitehall is not too far away. Do you know what I mean? So Jack, if you're listening, step out for belts. Come on, you've been called out. Go and defend your honor. Like I can't even think of an appropriate thing to say about him. I don't mind Jack Whitehall, actually, I have to say. I liked him in Fresh Meat. But I'd imagine
this
that's exactly what he's like in real life.
There's no disputing he's excellent what he does, and everyone can't get over the fact that I have this problem with him. For me, it's just whenever I see him on a panel show, if things aren't like it going, if the conversation isn't flowing in a way that he feels he can chip in, he'll steer it round so he can tell a bit that he's already got prepared. And that just does my head in. I'm like, no.
I know what you just mean.
It's mad. I know what you mean. I've really let go of a thing here.
Yeah, it's like have you remembered that I'm a funny person and I think of funny things for a living? You're not really working with me. Come on, sort yourselves out. Like, do you know what I mean? So yeah, you said this thing over here about climate change, but what about those Russians from medieval times?
That's totally.
Do you know that stuff? Yeah. Like, I don't know. I'd be a terrible comedian. I can't really think on the fly at all. The cleverest thing I've ever said was literally just there 10 minutes ago and I said act on it. So that's the pinnacle of my...
To be fair, that was good.
Look, I'm going to be dining out on that for the rest of my life because, as I said, that is the absolute pinnacle of my wit. So, and it's the cleverest thing I've ever said and only you and me have heard it. We're around to hear it. But it's okay because it's recorded. It's all good. Anyway, before I talk us into an absolute coma, before we let you go, Josh, where can people find you if they're wanting to get in touch with you? You mentioned Instagram, but where else? How do people get in touch with you?
Yeah, so on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, I'm the same everywhere. So I'm just at Josh Haberfield, which I imagine the perfect correct pronunciation and spelling will be in this in the details of this podcast. But yeah, you can find me on there. And I always enjoy, like, do feel free to reach out if you've got any questions, if you're like starting up, because it's great. And I did it. I continue to do it now. I continue to just message people because at the end of the day, the whole thing is kind of about who you know, not what you know. And it's it's good to make connections everywhere. You know, it's good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Josh, you're an absolute gentleman. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That was the Music Career Show. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and tell your friends about the Music Career Show.